Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito, one of the principals of Groundworks, Inc., and with my co-host, Alice Krieg, who is away this weekend, we design, build, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. Our show, We Dig Plants, broadcasts from two shipping containers in Bushwick, Brooklyn, located next to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street. Our sponsor today is Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. I've tasted their beef. It's amazing. So before we get into our show, I just want to thank Jimmy Carbone, co-host of Beer Sessions, for inviting us out to Pig Island on Governor's Island yesterday. It was amazing. It was really, really good food, great beer, and really good company. So thank you, Jimmy. It was a pleasure to be there. And it was a beautiful day, and it's harvest season. And this week on We Dig Plants, we continue with our Fruit of the Month Club series that started last month with the grape. Today is episode 2, the apple. That's the fruit that's been tempting humans from Adam and Eve to Snow White and influencing everyone from Calvin Klein to your first grade teacher. Now, New York City is not called the Big Apple because Peter Stuyvesant planted an apple from Holland on the corner of 13th Street and 3rd Avenue, but because it's such a perfect and apt symbol of our city, of promise, riches, knowledge, and sensuality. I think Peter just wanted to make sure he would have some hard cider on hand. That's why he planted it. And for me, it's the quintessential fall fruit. It's one of my favorites. It's been the object of numerous trips upstate with my family to pick our own, usually too many apples. I think last year we picked like 300 pounds of apples, Macintoshes, Macoons, and even some Red Delicious that actually tastes good as opposed to the, you know, mealy, awful cafeteria apples that you get. So what's more American than apple pie or more romantic than an apple orchard? Whenever Alice and I meet a new potential client and we see an apple tree gracing their house or their land, I know that it's someone that we're going to be able to work with, that they're going to be all right. So we're talking about Malus domestica, or the domesticated apple that traveled from far away to reach our shores and to fill our pies. And botanists speculate that its origins are the forested slopes of the Tian Shan Mountains of Kazakhstan. And humans have tinkered with the apple to make them sweeter and more vigorous for millennia. In fact, as early as 323 BC, Theophrastus discussed 6 varieties of apples and discussed grafting and general tree care. He also observed that seeds almost always produce trees with inferior quality fruit. So unlike the legend of Johnny Appleseed, most trees nowadays are not planted from seed. And we're going to get a little bit into that. So that leads us a little bit into apple botany. The apple is a member of the Rosaceae or rose family, which includes some of its obvious relatives like the pear and the plum, but also includes, interestingly, strawberries, raspberries, and even some ornamentals such as hawthorns and spirea, which we use a lot in the urban landscape. And all rose family members have 5 flower parts in fives or multiples of fives. So if you cut an apple down the center, you're going to find 5 chambers with about 2 seeds each. So the genus is Malus, and it has over 22 different species. And as I said, the species we're concerned with is the Malus domestica, which is a temperate zone tree. So it needs a cold winter or dormancy to set fruit in the spring. But what's interesting about the apple too, the domestic apple, is that it's so genetically diverse. It doesn't grow true from its seeds. So one tree can produce seedlings of like an astonishing diversity. One of my favorite apples, for example, the Macintosh, was a chance seedling found on an Ontario farm in 1811. And that turned out to be quite an important cultivar that's still being grown today. So that quality of apples mixing up its genes so prolifically makes it highly adaptable and makes it a great plant to experiment with in breeding programs. And these folks that study apples and other fruit trees, pomologists, work in an industry that produces over 220 million bushels of apples a year. And from what my understanding and research is, that they still come from, many still come from family-owned farms. So today, I have as our guest someone who knows these apple growers and the state of commercial apple growing a lot more intimately than I do, Stephen Hoying from Cornell University's Extension Service. Stephen, thank you for being on our show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Great. I'm going to share a little bit about you with our audience. Steve is well known to New York fruit growers and has a national and international reputation working with tree fruit and apples in particular. He served as cooperative extension educator in Western New York for tree fruit for 24 years before tackling the responsibility of conducting applied research on tree fruit and grapes at Cornell's Hudson Valley Lab in Eastern New York. He is now developing a comprehensive research and extension program on tree fruit and grapes with others at the lab. So I guess, Stephen, you're going to put apple and fruit and maybe cider making on the map again in New York State, I hope.
Well, I hope it hasn't been off the map for some time. New York is the second leading producer of apples in the country.
I will only eat an apple from New York, just so you know that. Not from Chile. So after his graduate work at Michigan State and the University of California, Davis, he first came to New York in 1982 as a specialist in integrated pest management. And having spent over 20 years assessing apple planting systems, he has vast experience with all aspects of developing efficient ways to grow apples. Over the years, there have been very few areas of tree fruit culture that he has not explored, including work on varieties, tree fruit nutrition, growth regulators, ground cover management, vigor control, and replant disease. His favorite extension activity is to work directly with commercial growers to help solve their production problems. So, Stephen, tell us a little bit about the history of commercial apple growing in New York State. Weren't apple orchards part of almost every farm?
Oh, they have been. It was a staple for people, and not only for the fresh fruit, but for the cider, because cider was something that wouldn't spoil. So every farm in New York would plant apple trees. In fact, in eastern New York, where farms were granted from the royalty, mm-hmm. That it was a requirement that people plant fruit trees on those farms.
That's interesting. And did they have to share some of their cider with the king? Is that part of it?
I wasn't there, but I'm sure that's true. I imagine they had taxes just like they do today.
Yeah, interesting. So so what kind of varieties did they typically grow then? And tell me about that and what kind of practices they used in the early part of our history.
Well, most of the varieties they grew were not anything like the ones that we grow today, because they were grown from seed, as you mentioned in your introduction, that there's a wide diversity, and every time you cross an apple and produce a seed and put that seed in the ground, you get a different variety of apple. So the way that they propagated trees was to just harvest the seeds from the fruit that they were eating and plant them out, and then after about 6 to 8 years, they'd have fruit, and they'd decide whether that particular tree was produce suitable fruit or not, and then they'd replant again. It wasn't until really into the 1800s, mid-1800s, when they started to graft trees so that they had the same variety that would be repeatable year after year.
That's really interesting. So they had sort of little mini experiments going on, and they had to wait quite a while before they could figure out what that apple tree was going to produce.
Yeah, actually, an apple from seed takes a very long time to get into production. They have what we call a very long extended juvenile period. And today, our growers don't have to go through that, because through research over decades, mm-hmm. people have developed rootstocks that they can graft these particular varieties on that will do all kinds of things for the commercial grower. It'll make trees smaller, and everybody's heard of dwarf trees now. We're growing apple trees now, more like the grape growers grow grapes in those same densities. They will resist diseases that are very important, very devastating. They will produce larger fruit, believe it or not, and they'll produce sweeter fruit as well. So the rootstock is an integral part of growing an apple.
That's really interesting to me. I mean, don't they use rootstocks that aren't even apple species?
Well, most of them on apples are different forms of apple species. At least they're Malus,
okay,
as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So, but these have been originally where most of the rootstock work was done was in England, and they mm-hmm. actually went out and looked at different varieties of trees, and they noticed that one tree might be smaller than another, so they started to use that fruit as a rootstock, or one particular type of tree would survive a soil disease, so they used that. And after they selected these, then they started breeding, making breeding crosses to enhance or improve the characteristics of each of those rootstocks.
So they would use things even like crabapple species or just anything that would be desirable, whatever trait they were looking for at the time.
Yes, exactly. And then they would say, well, this one is small and it's resistant to a certain root rot. Let's cross those and see if we can develop a rootstock that will have both of those characteristics. And they have successfully done that. In fact, today at Cornell University at the Geneva Experiment Station, we have a very active rootstock breeding program that is doing just that.
Hmm. So you were saying earlier that, and we'll get into more about your research in a little bit later in the show, but I'm very interested about the hard cider element of it. They were growing apples to make cider. Was it a profitable trade during that period? Did they make it just for their own consumption?
Yeah, as I understand it was mostly for their own consumption. There wasn't really a lot of safe things to drink during that period. So they did it mostly for their own consumption, and then I imagine, I wasn't there again, mm-hmm. successful apple growers were able to sell some of their product to taverns and other places.
Mm-hmm. So in New York State, are people making cider for sale now? Are they?
Well, there has been a resurgence in the production of hard cider. Mm-hmm. They've made sweet cider or non-alcoholic cider for a long time, and most people are only aware of it in the fall during harvest season, when all the supermarkets and farm markets
sure.
and everything carry their ciders. But now supermarkets are carrying ciders, sweet ciders, all year long, and you can get those in most of the progressive markets. And we have several producers of cider in mm-hmm. the state that supply them. The hard cider has become more of a resurgence type of product. Several of our growers looking for ways to diversify or to have ways of improving their profitability have looked into producing hard cider, and we have several in the state that are producing hard cider now.
Oh, that's great. I happen to like it. I don't know a lot of people that do yet, but I think it's been sort of far from our cultural practice and use for too long, you know? So it would be great if a farmer could make use of all their excess apples for perhaps a product that has a, you know, a wider appeal and perhaps a wider profit margin, you know?
Yeah, it's certainly the growers that have gotten into it certainly find it to be a very profitable product for them. And there's a number of different philosophies of how to make hard cider. There's the French philosophy where you put it into a wine bottle and you market it that way. There's kind of the English philosophy for putting it into bottles. Some people will use the traditional older heritage type varieties, the ones typical in England.
Mm-hmm.
And other people will use our usual varieties in a blend that makes a pretty nice hard cider.
Wow. Well, I also love the cider donuts that that are made with the apple cider. That's one of my favorite things to do at the Union Square Farmers Market. You can't just get enough of them. It's just amazing. Well, you mentioned earlier that New York State ranks second only to Washington State in apple production. So is it still viable? Is it still a viable enterprise for a family farm to have an orchard and sort of sustain themselves? What is the status of things right now?
Yeah, not particularly. I mean, if you're going to produce apples commercially and make a living at it, you pretty much have to have over 50 acres acres of apples. Mm-hmm. And 50 acres of apples doesn't lend itself to a general farm that grows other things. So most of our producers in the state are specialists. They grow, depending on which part of the state it is, they'll grow apples in particular, and then they'll grow other stone fruit like peaches or apricots or plums, and some small fruit like strawberries or raspberries or something that blends into their thing. But there's no really small apple producers, except those that can market right off the farm, and they might be a little bit smaller.
So that, yeah, I would imagine that it's so very, very seasonal. They would have to spread out their crops to have, you know, crops of different time periods and ripening, like the peaches, and mm-hmm. that's why so many farms, you can pick your peaches, you can pick strawberries, you can pick apples.
That's particularly true here in the Hudson Valley, where the fruit crops are more diversified. And the reason for that is because they have a large consumer base who can come directly to the farm and pick what they want. And there's also the green markets in New York City that they can serve, or small farm markets. Western New York, it's a completely different situation, where they have specialists that just grow processing apples for the production of applesauce, slices for pie, and also for juice.
Wow, that's...
So it's a completely different industry in Western New York than it is here in the Hudson Valley.
Well, I want to get into that a little bit more. We have to take a little bit of a break. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back in a moment.
When it's my moment in the sun, oh, how beautiful I'll be. But in a normal sort of way, like I am you and you are me.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. That was Moment in the Sun. And today we're having our Moment in the Sun with our guest, Stephen Hoying, who's graciously joining us from his office at Cornell on a Sunday to talk about apples. Thanks again, Stephen, for being with us on Sunday. We were talking a little bit about the difference between apple orchards in the Hudson Valley versus the western part of the state. And my understanding from a little bit of research that I did is that there's some families that have, you know, in the seventh or eighth generation of apple growing. Is that true upstate?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's not necessarily seventh or eighth generation of apple growing, mm-hmm. because those early generations may have had apples like we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But for several generations, maybe four or five, they have been growing apples commercially.
Wow. And apples have been a pretty important part of New York's economy for a long time. I read that by 1820, New York was exporting apples to England by schooner.
Right.
So now, tell me a little bit about where our apple crop ends up now that we're not drinking so much hard cider, even though I'm trying to do my part.
Our apple crop here in New York is exported all over the world.
Great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, we have a very strong export market, primarily to England. They love our Empire apples, so we have a big export market to England. Other areas of the world where they grow a lot of apples, it's a little bit more difficult. We don't send apples or too many apples to New Zealand or Australia, where they are also net exporters. But if you looked at a map, it would be a pretty good shotgun blast across the world where our apples go. Most of them, obviously, in New York are consumed in the eastern part of the United States.
That makes sense, sure.
It's kind of hard to go upriver and get them into Washington. And then California has a few export restrictions where it makes it very difficult for apples to get into there. But generally, you can find apples from New York just about anywhere in the United States.
Yes, I remember recently this summer I drove cross country, and I remember passing their big, you know, agricultural inspection station signs. It was the only state that I noticed had these.
Yeah, California, you mean, just just before you get into California.
Yeah. So yeah. How important are apples to New York's economy? I mean, talk to me in terms of dollars. How much money does it produce?
You know, I'm pretty ignorant on that in that area. I'm a cultural practices specialist that could tell you everything about growing them and everything. But in terms of what it means to New York State, I do know that that apples are an extremely important crop in New York's economy. Obviously, dairy and some other things are more important.
Sure. Well, we'll have to look into that and maybe put some of that information on our Facebook fan page. I'm sure Cornell has some of that information, I bet, on their website.
Yeah, and New York also has a very strong grower organization called the New York Apple Association, and they have a website that's just outstanding.
Okay.
For that, and that would probably be a very good one for most consumers to look at if they're interested in New York apples.
What is that website, Stephen? I'll share it with our audience.
Sure, you want it now?
Yeah.
It's www.nyapplecountry.com.
Great. Okay, I'm going to also post it on our Facebook fan page. So so I was reading also that most older orchards in the state have around 35 to 50 trees per acre. As you were saying, they're kind of spaced out. Now there's new planting systems that are putting up to 1,000 trees per acre. Tell me a little bit more about that and what's involved with that and what that means.
Yeah, now with the advent of the rootstocks, the dwarfing rootstocks, we've been able to plant our trees much closer together. The traditional orchard was 27 to 35 apples trees per acre, and that would take 10, 12, 15 years to get into full production.
Wow.
Now with the new rootstocks, because they're not only small, they're precocious, they come into bearing very quickly, that we can produce 60 or 70 bushels of apples per acre the year of planting or the year after planting. And what that does is that, yes, there's a lot more trees and a lot more cost involved, but your return is also earlier. So you're able to pay off the interest on any of the money you borrowed to put in this apple orchard sooner.
That is astoundingly fast for a fruit tree.
I planted an orchard here on our station this year, this spring, and picked 60 bushel of apples, which is it's about 50 pounds per bushel approximately, 60 bushel on this one-acre plot this fall.
Wow. So what technologies have allowed this to happen? What specific kinds of things have occurred to allow this process to be sped up?
Well, primarily the development of new rootstocks has been one, but also pruning and training systems, and that's one of the things that we've worked on primarily. The way you prune a tree, the way you train a tree, has a lot to do with how soon it'll produce apples.
I'm really glad that you mentioned that because I was going to ask you about pruning. I'm very famous among my gardening friends and gardening enemies for being a ruthless pruner of trees and shrubs.
And that's one of the worst things you could do with an apple tree.
Really?
The more you prune it, the more vegetative it'll want to be.
Interesting.
And the more vegetative it will be, the more it will resist producing fruit.
So I'm going to stay away with my pruners. But tell me about the types of pruning that are necessary for apples to be productive. I know it's probably something that is best described with a flow chart or something. But
well, I could spend a day talking about pruning, and I have. Generally, it depends on the spacing or the spacing that you're going to plant the tree.
Okay.
And like you mentioned earlier, that traditionally they were 27 trees to the acre, which was about 35 feet apart between the tree.
That's what I think of when I go apple picking. They're about that distance apart, yeah.
So what you'd have to do is you'd have to prune that tree very strongly to produce a strong framework in order to get that vegetative growth to fill that whole space.
Mm-hmm.
The exact opposite is what we're doing today. We're planting them no further than 3 feet apart. And so what we do is we'll remove any big branches, and then we won't prune it at all. We won't cut it back. And it will, in response, grow very small little shoots, maybe a foot or a foot and a half long, and then spurs. And those spurs will be productive and produce fruit, and then the fruit load on that tree will prevent it from growing anymore. So we can keep it in that 3 foot space by producing an annual crop of fruit.
So is that something similar to, you know, those old methods like espalier or Belgian fence at all?
Well, that, in a way, espalier and Belgian fence are both very structured systems that people really had to train. Now, with the espalier, the reason it fruits so early is because you bend the branch down, and that produces a hormonal effect that causes fruiting. So any kind of bending of an apple branch will stimulate reduce auxin production and stimulate cytokinin production, which are hormones, important hormones, and that will cause fruiting. So, so to do an espalier, you have to do a lot of bending. A lot of bending produces a lot of fruit.
Wow. So I'm trying to picture what these apple trees that are 3 feet apart look like. Do they just look like a big, you know, like a bush? Is it like a shrub?
Next time you come apple picking in the Hudson Valley, most of our growers who are commercial growers that pack and ship apples rather than do you pick, have planted these high-density systems. And it might be very easy to mistake them for grapes because there are trellises, and there are wire, and there are posts at each tree 3 feet apart. And if you didn't really pay attention, you wouldn't know they were apples.
Wow, I'm going to have to look for that the next time I go up. So I was also reading, Stephen, that The Apples of New York was this sort of big two-volume set that was published in 1905, and it listed over 1,000 varieties existing at that time. So now, from what I read, there are approximately 30 varieties in commercial production?
That's about right, yeah, and it varies. There has been a resurgence in new apple varieties more recently because people, well, it's kind of a supply and demand curve. You know, there's Red Delicious everywhere, and you can get Red Delicious from every different grower, so you can't command a high price in the grocery store. Some growers have found out that if they start producing boutique apples or apples with a very limited limited quantity, then they can command a higher price.
Yes, and that's definitely reflected in the supermarkets of New York. So,
well, we're actually very good in terms of the number of varieties that we have in our supermarkets now. I mean, you see new varieties from New Zealand and ones from Europe all the time.
Yeah, so what new varieties do you think are showing some promise and will become, you know, the sort of favorite apples of the future?
Well, right now there's one, everybody's probably familiar with Honeycrisp. Honeycrisp is really, in the scheme of things, a relatively new variety. Empire is an example. Empire was produced and named in the early 1960s. It really didn't become popular until the mid-80s in New York. So Honeycrisp has only been around for about 12 years now, and it's already taken over the market. The people who have developed Honeycrisp have found a new apple variety produced at the University of Minnesota, and they're going to start on a marketing campaign for that variety, and it's called Sweet Tango. So I believe that consumers in the United States will be seeing all kinds of new varieties in the future. Our growers here in New York have picked up two varieties that were produced at the Geneva Experiment Station at Cornell University. Right now, they have real sexy names, New York 1 and New York 2.
That'll change.
But eventually, and I don't believe it'll be too long, that our consumers will see these varieties on their store shelves.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's always nice to have new tastes. And it's just as there's been a resurgence with the heirloom vegetables, I think the same thing is going to happen with tree fruits, don't you think?
I do think so. At least I hope so.
And then maybe my son in his school cafeteria will not have the horrible, mealy red apple that he can't eat. What is it about those Red Delicious that makes them so mealy? Can you answer that?
Well, it mostly has to do with harvest. I mean, any fruit is going to suffer if it's not harvested correctly and on time. And it's not as easy to figure out when to harvest something like a Red Delicious that gets red in the middle of July, because color is one of the important ways to do it. There's also other considerations like marketing windows. Early market windows are more profitable than in the midstream of the season. So
sure. I'm imagining they pick them, in, like you said, early, and then they're stored somewhere for like a really long time. At least that's what they taste like, Stephen.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, apples right now, most apple varieties can be stored up to 12 months in controlled atmosphere storage, and that's been around for quite some time. But there are also other ways of manipulating the natural hormones within fruit to keep them on the tree longer and to make them store longer.
Mm-hmm.
So, to keep the business profitable, people have to do everything they can.
Of course, I understand that. And speaking of manipulating things, I was also interested to read about something called the gene gun and the use of this sort of antibacterial gene from a moth to sort of fight fire blight in apple trees. Is that research happening right now?
Yes, it is, actually. It's been going on for quite some time, and Dr. Mm-hmm. Herb Altwinkel at the Geneva Experiment Station has tried to put genetic material into the M26 rootstock. I know it's a little bit too technical, but
go on. Mm-hmm.
The M26 rootstock was extremely susceptible to fire blight, but it had a lot of great characteristics that our apple growers like to use. It was resistant to other diseases. It had a fairly small tree. It produced large fruit. It produced flat branch angles. Mm-hmm. The one drawback was it was extremely susceptible to fire blight, and even a little bit of fire blight, and it would kill the rootstock, which would kill the top of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
So what he has done is used several methods for introducing genes that will prevent fire blight. Now, originally, he did that using proteins from crayfish. And obviously, people don't want to think that their apples have crayfish in them.
Yes.
So
yes.
He has changed his research focus, and he's only looking at genes that come from apples now.
Okay.
So it's, right now he has a rootstock that our growers could use that is resistant to fire blight. But just the consumer preference about using animals in fruit is something that he doesn't think he can overcome. And I agree with him.
I have to agree with that. I think a lot of people, especially people listening to this radio station, would agree with that. A lot of gardeners, I know, for the reason that we're talking about, are afraid to grow fruit trees and apple trees specifically because of their reputation for attracting pests and diseases, as we were talking about. Can you briefly give our listeners some advice on planting and growing apple trees, maybe what varieties are best for the home grower and how to do it sustainably?
Oh, boy, another whole day. I think the key to growing in the East, growing apples in the East, is that we have just a tremendous complex of insects and diseases that will attack apples.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the New York State Experiment Station was founded because the apple industry was foundering because of apple scab and codling moth, two main pests. Breeders have been able to solve the disease problem, the apple scab and the powdery mildew problem, by producing apple trees that are called disease-free or disease-resistant. And
okay.
There are a number of varieties of disease-resistant apples that a grower can, that a person can plant.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with them is that the development of these were much later in time than some of the other more popular varieties, and they don't have all the great qualities of the ones that are still susceptible to diseases. So there's a couple of varieties, one called Mac Free, one called Nova Spy, one called Liberty. There's just a host of these disease-resistant ones. The insects have been a harder thing to conquer, and we've actually established a new planting here at the station where we're going to look at sustainable ways of growing organic apples. And the base of this is just what I mentioned. We have a whole variety of different disease-resistant trees mm-hmm. that we've planted. There are some sustainable organic ways to produce apples, and people are doing that. They're certified to do that here in New York. Unfortunately, it's a lot more expensive and time-consuming than it is to do it with traditional methods. So, they found that in most cases they can't command the higher price that'll make it profitable. But some growers are able to do it with specialized markets.
Yes, that's interesting. I mean, people, you know, when they want organic produce, but they also want it to be perfect. You know,
and cheap and less expensive.
Yes, and that's definitely a challenge. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm going to post a link to the website for your research station and for Cornell. I really appreciate it, and they can take a look at it on our Facebook fan page. We hope to have you again sometime in the future.
It's been my pleasure. I'd love to come back.
Okay. I'd just like to end by saying that Michael Pollan and his book, The Botany Desire, chose the apple as a symbol of sweetness, and we've been in love with apples for millennia. An apple tree is a long-term investment, taking 5 to 10 years of growth and attention from the farmer before it bears fruit. So consider that when you take a bite. Thank you to Jack Kinsley for producing, Nat Wiener for engineering. Thank you to Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, and also to Hearst Ranch, our sponsor. If you miss any part of the show or you want to listen again, it's available via archive on the website heritageradionetwork.com and via podcast at iTunes. Please leave a comment on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. See you in the orchard.